Parshat Chukas opens with the Chukas HaTorah, the Chok of Parah Aduma, the mitzvah which is beyond our understanding. And at a certain point, we don't know exactly the depth, the meaning of Parah Aduma, but we do know what it does. The ashes of the Parah Aduma are sprinkled on a person. That's what purifies him from Tumas Mace if he came into contact with a mace. And a pasuk, a little bit into the parsha, which is pasuk yudalad, perik yutes pasuk yudalad, describes the process and begins zos haTorah adam ki yomos ba'ohel. A person will die in the ohel, kol abo el ohel v'chol asher ba'ohel yitmashiv as yomim. Anyone who goes into that domain, this is the din of tumas ohel, can contract tumor for 7 days. We note that this halacha is introduced with the word zos haTorah, and it seems to be somewhat more global than the subject at hand. We are dealing with Torah's hames, Torah's tumas mes, but the Torah does not introduce with the word zos Torah's hames. It introduces with a much more general and seems all-encompassing term, Zos HaTorah. Apparently, this is the Torah. This is the entire Torah. And that is why Chazal understand that there is a certain emanation from the Pasuk which actually is a statement about the Torah in general. And these are the famous words of Reish Lakish. They're mentioned in the Talmud, Maseches Brachos and Maseches Shabbos. The pasuk says, "Zos haTorah Adam ki yomos ba'ohel." This is the Torah, person who dies in an ohel. Amar Reish Lakish, "Ein divrei Torah miskaimin, ela b'misha meimis atzmo aleha." In order for the Torah to endure, Adam ki yomos ba'ohel, a person needs to die in the tent. Meaning, this is recommended. This is the course that one should follow. If a person wishes to attain Torah, he needs to be Adam ki yomos ba'ohel. He needs to die in the tent of Torah. Of course, this is rather startling for us. What is the meaning of these words? What is the goal or the intent of Adam ki yomos ba'ohel? Perhaps it means that a person applies themselves to the nth degree, to the best of their abilities, with all of their strength. But perhaps there is something else, another concept embedded within Adam ki yomos ba'ohel. There is a Mishnah in Pirkei Avos. In the end of the third perek, I think it's one of the more unusual Mishnayos, if one could classify it in that way, for reasons that I think we'll see. It's from Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. He authored the first Mishnah, and then, Hu haya omer, kol shechachmaso meruba mimasov, anyone whose wisdom exceeds his deeds, lamahu domer, what is such a person like? He is analogous to le'ilan, a tree, she'anafav merubim, it has many branches, v'sharashav mu'atim, few roots, v'haruach va'a, v'okarto, v'ofachto alpanav, the wind shall blow, it will take under the many branches, and uproot it, and overturn it. Shina emar, and quotes a pasuk to illustrate this type of tree. And it's a pasuk from the Navi Yirmiya, Perik Yud Zayin, v'hayak ke'ar ba'arava, it will be like a lone tree, an arid land, v'lo yirek yavo tov, it won't see any good, etc., and so forth. The converse, kol shema'asov meruba mechachmaso, a person whose deeds exceed their wisdom. So what is he like? Lamahu domer, le'ilan sha'anofav mu'atim, it has few branches, v'shirashav merubim, many roots, sha'afilu kol arucha sheba'olam, bo'os v'noshos bo, if all the winds of the world will come and blow, en mezizin oso mimakomo, they will not budget from its place. She'ne'emar, and quotes again from the same Perek in Yirmiyahu, Vayaka Eitcha Sulal Mayim. This is a description of a tree that is rooted in fertile land. There's much water there, and the pasuk proceeds. Of course, there are a number of questions regarding this Mishnah. Firstly, it speaks in praise of a person whose deeds exceed their wisdom, and it speaks critically of a person whose wisdom exceeds his deeds. But the question is, why is it wrong? What is the problem with a person whose wisdom exceeds their deeds? On the contrary, if you talk about someone whose deeds exceed their wisdom, it sounds like some of what they do is done without wisdom. How is that possibly laudable? Why is that considered a positive thing? I would say that what the Mishnah criticizes is actually the better state. His wisdom encompasses his deeds, everything is done with wisdom, as opposed to the converse, which sounds like there are certain deeds that he does out of lack of wisdom. How is that possibly a good thing? Secondly, the moshel, it's rather obscure. He's like a tree. One is like a tree with many branches and few roots, and one is the other way around. What exactly are the branches? What are the roots? And when the wind comes, if there's too many branches and not enough roots, it uproots the tree. But what is this a reference to? It's very specific, but we can get lost in the trees a little bit, unless we have a sense of what the moshel is depicting. And finally, and interestingly, these psukim, where are they from? We mentioned the source, they're from the Navi Yirmiyahu, Perek Yud Zayin. But if you look in the Navi there, you will see that he doesn't seem to be describing what the Mishnah is describing. The Mishnah adduces these psukim of the tree that's rooted in arid land or in fertile land as a person who either has more wisdom than deeds or more deeds than wisdom, whatever that means. But the way that we were originally used, these two psukim, by the Navi Yirmiyahu, is not about this at all. Rather, and these psukim, one of them at least, is very familiar to us, when it says, Baruch HaGever, Ashe Yivtach Bashem, Vaya Hashem Yivtacho, what we say at the end of benching, that's from the Navi Yirmiyahu, happy is the person who trusts in Hashem, and about him, the Navi brings us this image of the tree, Eit Shasul Al Mayim. The converse is, Arur HaGever Ashe Yivtach Ba'Adam. Cursed is the person who trusts in man. He is the Arar Ba'arava. He's the lone tree in the arid land. Now that's a subject that is rather different than what the Mishnah is talking about. It seems, therefore, that the Mishnah has lifted, or hijacked, even the psukim from their original context about trusting in Hashem, trusting in a person, and applied them to something else entirely. Is that acceptable? All of these questions, and many more, are raised by the Abarbanel in his Pirush Nachalas Avos to Pirkei Avos. And Abarbanel explains that the concept of a person who his deeds exceed his wisdom, or his wisdom exceed his deeds. Why is it wrong? Why is it a negative trait for his wisdom to exceed his deeds? The reason why is because the deeds that we're talking about are Ma'asim Tovim, they're mitzvahs, they're Torah acts. If a person's wisdom exceeds his deeds, what that means is he will never act, he will never perform a mitzvah unless he is confident that he understands exactly what it's all about. He will never move unless his wisdom exceeds his deeds. He will never perform a mitzvah unless to his satisfaction it makes sense. And in a sense, such a person has failed to connect with what Torah is, because he has given the Torah, and he has given HaKadosh Baruch Hu, who is behind the Torah, no credit. Because what he's saying is, the fact that HaKadosh Baruch Hu alone has told me to do the mitzvah isn't enough yet. I would not want to proceed unless I was also satisfied that it's a good thing. So far, all I know is that God thinks it's a good thing. But until I also understand it to be a good thing, I'm not moving. The person whose deeds exceed his wisdom is someone who has given HaKadosh Baruch Hu that credit, as if to say, I'm trying, I'm working to understand as best I can, the mitzvahs that are beyond reach currently, those whose deeds are in excess of my wisdom. So for that, I trust that they are nonetheless positive things, given as they were commanded by HaKadosh Baruch Hu, who knows a bit more about this than I do. And looked at in this way, we firstly understand why it is that one whose wisdom exceeds his deeds in this manner of speaking is a very negative thing. It is the opposite of Torah. Moreover, says Abarbanel, we will then understand how the psukim, as they are applied in the Mishnah, are exactly the same as they are originally referred to in the pasuk. Because upon reflection, when a person is expecting for the mitzvahs to make sense, to get an insight into the mitzvahs, he is ultimately judging them based on what he considers to be a valid reason, and those reasons essentially are a product of what he has learned from other people, what he's been taught, what he observes. And ultimately, therefore, the yardstick as to whether something is valid, whether a mitzvah is meaningful, will only be ratified by him, essentially, if it receives the okay based on what he has learned is defined as positive or moral or spiritual. But those are things he learned from other people. This is a person, essentially, who has put his trust in man. He's put his trust in the age in which he lives, the wisdom of the time in which he lives, in that setting, and that for him represents the ultimate arbiter of truth and meaning. And that is why when the Navi Yirmiyahu says, Arur HaGever Sheivtach Ba'Adam, cursed is the person who trusts in man more than he trusts in God, it is describing exactly the same as the Mishnah is when it talks about someone whose wisdom exceeds his deeds. And by contrast, when the Navi Yirmiyahu said, Baruch HaGever Sheivtach Ba'Shem, happy is the blessed is the person who trusts in Hashem, that is what the Mishnah is describing as someone whose deeds exceed his wisdom. That is what allows his deeds to exceed his wisdom, because he trusts in HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And this is an important point to be aware of, for very often when a person judges things in terms of their own ideas, rarely does a person have an idea or a value system that is purely their own. It is, by and large, a product of the age and time in which they live. And essentially, therefore, a person has placed his stock with Basar Vadam, placed his stock with the people around him. And as the Mishnah says, the difference between those two is it gives you a different type of tree entirely. A person who has trusted in man, whose wisdom exceeds his deeds, so he is liable to be affected by the wind. And what is the meaning of that? It means that currently society says one direction, and that's the way that I go. But he has very few roots, because as the wind changes, and he has placed so much investment in the way the wind was originally blowing, then when there's a counter wind, it can completely overturn him. But the tree that is not affected by this is the tree that is rooted in the timelessness of the Torah given by HaKadosh Baruch Hu. There's a few branches. Everybody lives in the time and place that they live. But here's a person, as the winds blow this way and that way, and it's depending on the month or the year or whoever's in office or whoever's the best seller at that time. So these winds are blowing in all different directions, and here's a person who remains firm. And this is one of the most important lessons to learn about Torah. On the one hand, we're looking to apply the timelessness of Torah to the timely questions of our age. But to try and do the opposite is a disservice, ultimately, to Torah, and a mistake about what Torah is all about. The Navi in Shmuel, when it describes the bringing of the Aron from the Plishtim to Yerushalayim, so there was a tragic episode at that time, the famous Peretz Uzzah. whereby you had the oxen and they were pulling in a cart, they were drawing the Aron. And at a certain point, it looked like the Aron was about to fall. Uzzah stretched out his hand to steady the Aron, and he was killed. And that was Peretz Uzzah. And Rav Kook raises the question, what did Uzzah do that was so wrong? After all, it does look as if the Aron is about to fall. Should he have let it fall? At the end of the day, he was only looking to bring it back into balance. It sounds like a mitzvah. It was a fatal error. What was the error? And Rav Kook answers, and clearly his answer is intended way beyond the episode of Peretz Uzzah, that indeed there were animals and they were drawing the Aron, and at a certain point they were imbalanced one with the other. They were not in accord one with the other. The way the animals were going and the way the cart was going and the Aron, it wasn't working out. What was the mistake of Uzzah? His mistake, says Rav Kook, was instead of straightening the Aron to bring it in line with the animals, he should better have straightened the animals to bring them in line with the Aron. And the intent is, very often, there is something of a discord. There's not exactly a straight line in terms of the way people are and the way the Torah is. In such an imbalanced case, and they should be brought into line, but what should be brought into line with what? The Aron, the eternal Aron, in terms of the way the animals happen to be walking now, or perhaps vice versa. The difference between those two answers, ultimately, as we saw from that episode, is the difference between life and death. And this, perhaps, is an aspect of what the Gemara means when it says, Ein divrei Torah miskaimin ela b'misha meimis atzmo aleha. Divrei Torah don't remain with a person unless he has killed himself. As soon as we understand that the atzmo here, the person's ideas, which he will hold fast to, are perhaps the product of his time and his age, he may view them as universal truths, but they're universal truths today and here. If you move to a different country, they may believe the opposite. And 100 years ago, they may, even in this case, in this place, have believed the opposite, and perhaps may do so again in 100 years' time. That's the way the winds blow. But if a person holds fast to that atzmo, then in a sense, he may never actually have divrei Torah enduring in him. Because as much as he encounters words of Torah, but it will be a self-defining process. Having already established what are the ultimate universal truths, any words of Torah he meets that are in accord with that, he will receive benignly. Any words that challenge that or in discord with that, he'll put to the side, which means that the shape of this person will be exactly the same as he emerges from years and years of involvement with Torah as they were when he came in, because the atzmo was what dictated play all along. So he came in with atzmo and he leaves with atzmo, but there's no divrei Torah there. For a person to attach himself to the eternity of Torah, he needs to put atzmo in perspective. He needs to recognize those limitations. And as much as he uses the best of his intellectual powers, which draw off his time and age, he uses them to encounter something which goes far beyond that. And I think this perhaps is why this message is given to us in the beginning of Parshas Chukas. Of all places to talk about the way that one should learn Torah, Parshas Chukas, of course, is the ultimate mitzvah that stands beyond a person's understanding. There is no atzmo in Parah Adumah. And ultimately, says the Torah, that's not only true for Parah Adumah, Zos HaTorah, it's true for the entirety of Torah. I would like to add to this a fascinating insight into Parah Adumah and human understanding and these questions that really engage us on an ongoing basis. For Parah Adumah, we know, is the quintessential chok, and we don't understand what it's about, and that's that. But amazingly, the Medrash tells us that that will not always be the case. In Bamidbar Rabbah, the beginning of Parshas Chukas, Devarim hamechusim mikem ba'olam hazeh, Things that are hidden from you in this world, asidim lihios tsefuyim ba'olam haba. In the future, in times to come, the world to come, they will be apparent to you. Dichtiv, and quotes a pasuk in the Novi Yeshaya Perik Membeis, v'holachti ivrim, ivrim with a vav, that is to say, the blind, iver, v'holachti ivrim baderech lo yot'u, I will guide the blind along a path that they never knew. Now, what the Medrash is telling us is, amazingly, that Parah Aduma is currently a chok. It's currently off limits. But in the fullness of time, we will come to understand it, or have an understanding of it. And the Beis Halevi, in Parshas Bo, asks two questions. Number one, which is, if you're Jewish, you have to ask this question. Well, why can I not understand it now? If ultimately I'll understand it, so why wait? Whatever the reason should be as applicable now as it is later on. So why can I not understand it now? Secondly, the way the Medrash has used this pasuk in Yeshaya, v'holachti ivrim baderech lo yodu, I'll guide the blind in a way that they never knew before. Now the Medrash clearly understands that they are being guided in an understanding of mitzvos, specifically the Parah Aduma. But the pasuk doesn't mean that in context, although there is no question that the pshat of the pasuk is a reference to guiding the Jewish people towards redemption, out of galus, where they're blind, into a world that they never knew before, a path they never knew before. So you have a very interesting duality within how to look at this pasuk, whereby the pshat was and always will remain a reference to the destiny of the Jewish people, they're being guided out of galus, and somehow alongside of that, the Medrash tells us that they're being guided in their understanding of certain mitzvahs. What is the meaning of all of this? So the Beis Halevi refers us back to the Haggadah Shel Pesach. And of course, the one who always gets the most attention of the four sons is the Rasha. I think that remains true, and not only in Haggadah Shel Pesach. And his question is, Rasha Mahu Omer, Moha Avodah Hazos Lachem. What's it all about? Why are you involved in Avodah? And that's, of course, a wrong question to ask. And the answer that we give him is, Ba'avozeh Asa Hashem Li B'tzeisi Mimitzrayim. In the Chumash, that is not the answer that follows this pasuk, but in the Haggadah, it is attached to this question. So you ask, Ma Avodah Hazos Lachem? And the answer is, Ba'avozeh Asa Hashem Li B'tzeisi Mimitzrayim. Of course, with the accompanying sting of Li V'lo Lo, just to resonate with his Lachem V'lola. But how exactly is this an answer to his question? Is it merely to push him aside, to condemn him? Have we answered the question? It's interesting as well that both his question and the answer need to be examined just in terms of whether they read in a straight line. When he asks, Moha Avoda Azos Lachem, which is a Rasha question, does he only have a problem with this Avoda? Apparently. He doesn't seem to have issues with Avoda generally. He doesn't say Mo Havoda Lachem, he says Mo Havoda Hazos Lachem. What is his issue with the Avoda of Korban Pesach? And in terms of the answer we give him, we say Ba'avorzeh Asa Hashem Li B'Tzeisi Mimitzrayim. Now, if we look at those words closely, we will see that they do not say what we normally paraphrase them as saying. For how would we translate freely? For this Hashem did to me when I left Mitzrayim. It's actually a difficult pasuk to read. What do we mean when we say ba'avorzeh? For the sake of this, Asa Hashem li b'tzeisi mimitzrayim. The answer, explains Beis Halevi, is that the Rasha, he's not a fool. The other sons fill those categories. They check those boxes. The Rosh is a Chacham. And his question of Ma Ha'avodah Azos Lachem is a reference to a time when it seems that the meaning and the reason behind the mitzvah of Korban Pesach, perhaps, has run its course? After all, what was the original Korban Pesach about? The original Korban Pesach was full of meaning. The sheep is the Avodah Zorah of the Egyptians, and here we are, and we're looking to confront them, and to refute them, and to reject that Avodah Zorah. And thus, Korban Pesach. Lidoros, that type of confrontation doesn't seem to be there anymore. Worship of sheep seems to have faded, as does Avodah Zorah ultimately in pretty much all forms. The only ones who continue to make a reference to Avodah Zorah are us, with the Korban Pesach, rejecting something that doesn't exist anymore. And the Rosh is therefore asking, why do you continue to do the Avodah in this way? Are there not so many other timely, appropriate ways to celebrate your freedom? In order to fully explain what the Korban Pesach is about, nowadays you first need to explain to a child what Avodah Zarah is. Otherwise he has no context. What is the answer to this question? There is a fundamental principle contained within this pasuk, because it actually reads backwards than what we would have expected. We understand the reason why we keep the mitzvah is because of what happened when we left Mitzrayim. When we left Mitzrayim, so many things happened, and that is why we do these mitzvahs. The pasuk says the opposite. The pasuk doesn't say, because this is because we left Mitzrayim. The pasuk says, it is because of this that we left Mitzrayim. And what does that mean? We know the Torah, in pure form, predates the world. The Avos are keeping 613 mitzvahs in whatever way is relevant to them. Among those mitzvahs, Pesach, Matzah, and Maror. If you learn Chumash with Rashi, you will know that Avram is baking matzahs, and Yitzchak is eating the Korban Pesach, and even Lot, even the renegade Lot, he's not going to eat chametz on Pesach. He's not that much of a friar. He lives in Sodom, but in Pesach is... Umatzos ofa vayochelu. Says Rashi, Pesach haya. What are they doing? What are they commemorating? Nothing's happened yet. But of course, we must understand that many of these mitzvahs that we call commemorative mitzvahs, that cannot be the be-all and end-all of the mitzvah if the Torah itself precedes history. So the mitzvah can't be a response to history if the mitzvah came before. There must be something about the mitzvah, the essence of the mitzvah, that transcends history. And moreover, not only is the essence of the mitzvah beyond history, but if there is a relationship between the historical event and the mitzvah, it is more correctly reversed. Because if the mitzvah represents an ultimate and eternal truth, then on the contrary, it is the history of the Jewish people that is modeled on that. And this is what the response ultimately to the Rosha is, Moha Avodah Azos Lachem, why are you doing this Avodah? Isn't this no longer an appropriate response to that event? The answer is, the be-all and end-all of Korban Pesach is not a response to that event. On the contrary, the event has the effect relationship to the cause of the mitzvah. Ba'avor zeh, Asa Hashem li b'tzeisei mi'mitzrayim. The mitzvah came first. And therefore, it's not even correct to say, ultimately, that the reason why we do this mitzvah is because we left Mitzrayim. It's more correct to say, it is in order to keep these mitzvahs that we left Mitzrayim. Because the mitzvahs were here first, and that is why we left in a hurry. We had the mitzvah of matzah before we left in a hurry. So the original matzah was not to commemorate leaving in a hurry. On the contrary, we left in a hurry because that is in line with what the mitzvah of matzah represents about the Jewish people, about Torah. And therefore the mitzvahs endure. What's interesting is, therefore, we learned a lot about the mitzvahs of Pesach by leaving Mitzrayim. And that's why the pasuk goes on to say, V'shamarta es ha-chukah hazos lemo'ada miyomim yomima. The chukah hazos refers to the Korban Pesach. Why is it called a chok? It would appear to be the least chok-like mitzvah in the Torah. It is entirely commemorative. But when we say that Yetzias Mitzrayim was orchestrated in the way that it was in order to be in line with the mitzvah, so the mitzvah emerges as being much more and way in excess of that event. Ultimately, it's a chok itself, and therefore it is to be kept lemo'ado in its time, miyomim yamima, for all times. Where does this leave us with regards to Parah Aduma? Parah Aduma is for the future, what Korban Pesach was for the past. The Medrash tells us that the attributes of Parah Aduma, Aduma, Tamima, Ein Bamum, Lo Ala Aleha Ol, those are references to the Arba Golios, and the burning of the Parah Aduma refers to the ultimate reducing of the forces of the Arba Golios to ashes. The Osaf Ish Tahor, and then the pure man gathers together, says the Medrash, that's HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Hashem Ish Milchama, he gathers the Jewish people together. How will that happen? We don't know. But when it does happen, one thing we do know. As surely as the way in which we left Mitzrayim was modeled after the mitzvahs of Korban Pesach, Matzah, and Maror, which preceded those events, then the Geula HaAsida will also take a form that is faithful to the details and the principles of Parah Aduma. And as surely as looking back, once we left Mitzrayim, we understood more what Korban Pesach is about and Matzah is about, having left in a hurry and having confronted the Mitzrayim in that time of Avodah Zarah, that gave us a deeper understanding as to what these mitzvahs are about. So we are to understand and anticipate that the way in which we leave Golus ultimately will also illuminate our eyes as to what Korban, what the Parah Aduma is about. It's an absolute eye-opener, literally, because, says the Beis Halevi, that is how the two understandings of that pasuk in Yeshaya go together. V'olachti ivrim baderech asher lo yodu. I will lead the blind in a way they never saw before. In what way are they blind? They don't know how to get out of Golus and they don't understand the Parah Aduma. But when they're led out of Golus, that itself will give them an understanding of Parah Aduma. Not a complete understanding, as surely as Korban Pesach remains a chok even after we left Mitzrayim, Parah Aduma will remain a chok even after the future Geula. But an insight, an encapsulation in historical form, some form of way of relating to the mitzvah, that we will have in the way the Geula will happen. And that's why it's specifically that for the future. So this is really an unbelievable statement on the part of the Beis Halevi in terms of Parah Aduma, present and future. I'd like to turn our attention now to certainly what is has and will remain the center of Parshas Chukas, although many things happen in Chukas. I wonder if we've ever spoken about anything else. It's the Mei Meriva. It's the hitting of the rock. And there are a number of questions that we need to ask. Some of them we've asked in the past, and we will try and formulate a certain approach towards this central episode this evening. As we know, the problem was, or is conventionally taken as, Moshe was told to speak to the rock, and in the end he hit the rock, and that was a terrible mistake. The first question is, why is it such a terrible mistake? What is the difference ultimately between them? But to put it rather mildly, I think we would personally be happy if we could do either of them. Because rocks generally do not spout forth with water for millions of people, not if you speak to them, and not if you hit them. So it seems to be a rather subtle difference, but how can it be the difference between something positive and something negative? Moreover, and this is the Ramban's question, If the last thing Moshe is meant to do is hit the rock, why is the first thing that he's told to do to take his staff? Which it is in Perek Kaf, Pasuk Ches, Pasuk Zayin, Vayedaber Hashem Moshe Limor, Kach es amateh, take the staff. That is the last thing you want to be holding if you wish to avoid at all costs hitting the rock. Moreover, as we look at this Pasuk Ches and we pay careful attention to it, we should notice something of a redundancy. As it says, Kach es amateh, Vakele so'eda atov aron achicha, V'dibartem el ha'sela le'enehem, V'nasan meimav. Speak to the rock, it will give forth its water, V'hotzei so'lehem mayim min ha'sela, and take out water from the rock. What's there to take out if the water is already given? The Pasuk began by saying, V'nasan meimav, so if it gives its water, what's to take out? So why does the Pasuk continue with the words, V'hotzei so'lehem mayim min ha'sela? It's a good question. Pasuk Tes, V'yikach Moshe es ha'mateh, Milifnei Hashem, Kasher tzivahu. Moshe takes the staff. Milifnei Hashem. What is the meaning of those words, Milifnei Hashem? Milifnei Hashem, before Hashem, refers to the Ohel Moed. That means that Moshe's staff is in the Mishkan. That's where the man is, place it Lifnei Hashem, and anything that's called Lifnei Hashem is in the Mishkan. Our question is, what is Moshe's staff doing in the Mishkan? Why is it not with Moshe? Moreover, back to hitting versus talking. In hindsight, it was a terrible mistake, but it was a mistake made by Moshe Rabbeinu. Why did he make that mistake? If he's not meant, if there's ample reason for him not to hit the rock, so why does he hit it? If it's the wrong thing to do, why does he do it? In Pasuk Yud, he addresses Bnei Yisrael. Vayakilu Moshe v'Aaron esakal pnei asola. Vayomer lahem. Moshe says, Shimunu hamorim, haminasela hazen utzilachem mayim. Shimunu hamorim. Speak now, morim. Teachers, rebels, what does he mean by referring to them as Morim? And his question also needs to be understood. Shall we take out water from this rock? Is that a rhetorical question? Because it actually sounds like a very good question, but it also has a very good answer, being yes, please. Because that's what they're all there for. So why is it phrased in such a rhetorical way? Shall we take out water from the rock? Yes. Proceed. Take out water from the rock. What is he waiting for? So this year we place ourselves in the hands of the Netziv in the HaMikdavar. And he has an approach to the Meimariva, to this episode, which as we will see extends beyond this one event of Meimariva. For the truth of the matter is, it relates to the entire question of where the Jewish people are heading. As we know, life in the Midbar for the Jewish people, very different than Eretz Yisrael. They have everything they need. They receive it with no investment. The food comes from heaven. They've got Moshe Rabbeinu. They have perfect conditions. But it's unnatural. Life in Eretz Yisrael, relatively speaking, much more natural. The food comes from the ground, for example, not from the sky. And it takes a while, and it needs investment. That's without a doubt a transition. And we should know further, and this is the major point of the Netziv. Of course there's a transition from life in the Midbar to life in Eretz Yisrael. We need to appreciate, however, that transition does not take place in 10 minutes that it takes them to cross the Yarden. As if to say, well, as long as they are on the east side of the Yarden, life is Midbar mode. And as soon as they cross over, it's Eretz Yisrael mode. It's a transition that is a process. And in fact, says the Netziv, it's rather analogous to the process of weaning. A child doesn't go from milk to solids in 60 seconds. It's a process, and moreover, there is actually a time when the two are combined. Whereas the original way of receiving food and the way that he will ultimately come to receive food, he gets something of both until it moves. And this, as an Atziv, is the understanding of year 40 in the Midbar. What will be from really a little bit into Parshas Chukas till the end, that is a transitional time. It is no longer exactly like things were from the beginning in the Midbar. On the one hand, they're still in the Midbar, but on the other hand, they're already acclimatizing and formatting themselves to life in Eretz Yisrael. What form does this take? Well, we find the Jewish people coming much closer to quote-unquote civilization than they ever had. They're really very close to established towns, and they begin to establish their own connections. They send diplomatic missions. We'd like to pass through your land. It doesn't, the Aron at this stage is no longer flattening everything in front of them until further notice. They need to go about things in a somewhat more natural way. And there are wars, which they haven't had for a while, because that's life as you try and enter into another country. Moreover, there is one object, shall we say, that really embodies and represents this miraculous type of existence. And that is the Mater of Moshe. Moshe's staff is the instrument through which HaKadosh Baruch Hu empowers him to perform miracles. Hore mismatcha, and in fact in HaKadosh Shel Pesach, as we attach a definition to Vayetzienu Hashem Elokeinu Misham, Be'al Chazaka, V'zorna Tuya, Uva Osos, with signs and what? With signs, says the Haggadah, the Osos, Zehamate. That's the Mate. The Mate was an instrument of signs. And as Moshe carries it with him wherever he goes, that's the way that the Jewish people are going. They're living a life of wonders. And in year 40, lo and behold, the staff is put away. Put into storage. It's taken out of circulation. Moshe doesn't have it with him anymore. Because that's not how life is going to be anymore. And that is why Mater Moshe currently resides in year 40 in the Mishkan. The supernatural appurtenances of life in the Midbar are the Anane HaKavod, and they are the Be'er, and they are the Man. And we find, beginning in Parshas Chukas, they begin to disappear. And on the one hand, the goal is to try and acclimatize without them, and then they have covered, for example. But on the other hand, you can't do without water. Which means as the Be'er of Miriam disappears, it needs to be brought back. However, it needs to be brought back in a more natural way, if we can describe it that way. As if to say, so far, what have the Jewish people done to receive water? Nothing. Miriam was there. In her merit, there is water. They never had to ask for it. They never had to daven for it. It's there. As the well of Miriam disappears, because Miriam passed away, so they need to get it back. How are they going to do that? Well, the way they normally do things when they need something in this type of situation is they go to Moshe and they say, "You're Moshe, do a miracle." But here, HaKadosh Baruch Hu wishes to wean the Bnei Yisrael off miracles in that way. They're not meant to be getting things that way anymore. They're being weaned off them. Or to put it slightly differently, the goal of this episode is for the Jewish people to reclaim the well of water in an Eretz Yisraeldika way, in a more natural way. What is the way that life in Israel, what happens when there's no water? Well, as we know, there's a whole Masechta about this. Maseches Tanis. If water is withheld, there is a way to go about establishing a connection with HaKadosh Baruch Hu within Eretz Yisrael. It takes the form of people getting together and someone speaks to them and says to them words of Torah, and then they daven for rain. What they would call today, Atzeret Hit'orerut. That's how you get water in Eretz Yisrael. In the Midbar, you go to Moshe and say, do something. In Eretz Yisrael, you get together and you examine your deeds. And you daven. And so, HaKadosh Baruch Hu says to Moshe, Kaches Hamate. He tells him to take the staff, for reasons that we will see. But now, HaKel Sa'eda, get everyone together. This is the first Atzeret Hit'orerut. There's no water, the Jewish people need to come together. V'dibartem el ha'sela le'eneihem, and speak to the rock. Now when it says to speak to the rock, the Sifrei has a most astounding comment. For what is he meant to say? It doesn't say. Speak to the rock. Says the Sifrei, say words of Torah. Perek Echad, Halacha Achas. Say Torah. And what does this mean? It means that this is a ma'amad, this is a gathering that should be centered around words of Torah. And that's how you get water. That's how it's going to be done in Eretz Yisrael. And that is why the pasuk says, V'dibartem el ha'sela le'eneihem v'nosan me'mav. The Nasan Meimav is a natural result. It's a natural reaction. It will give forth its water. When something gives forth, it means it happens naturally, because this is the more natural way for the water to come. And by the way, this is not only an instruction to Moshe, but also to Aaron. There is no restriction on only one person speaking to the Jewish people at a time of this. Moshe can speak to them, Aaron can speak to them, each one in his own way, each one will resonate with a different segment, a different aspect of the Jewish people, and between the two of them, the Jewish people will rise to the occasion and daven. Now, of course, nothing is guaranteed, as if to say, should it be that the Jewish people do not rise to the occasion? That is to say, they're not ready to be weaned in this way. And they still prefer the good old-fashioned way. Of just Moshe does it, and they're not ready. So what shall the response be? No rain? Or no water? Says the Netziv, once again, when you try and wean a child, you hope for the best, but you need a contingency plan. In the event that he doesn't take to the new food, you can't say, well, you know, he's got to learn his lesson. There's always a backup plan. He stays with the old until perhaps one could try again a bit later on. And therefore, HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, plan A is v'dibartem el ha'sela. That's the natural way. That's what we're looking to achieve here. The nosan meima. Should it prove inoperable, it won't work out for whatever reason, so they're not going to be left to die of thirst just because they didn't get it right. So take the mate, because you may need it. The hutsei salahemayim min ha'sela. Plan B is you may need to extract it. Ideally, you should give it naturally. You may need to extract it unnaturally, in the way that you've been doing until now. And we should bear in mind that, which we will come to soon, the terrible mistake of hitting the rock. Originally, when they left Mitzrayim in Parshas Beshalach, Moshe was told to hit the rock. V'hikis ha'batzur. So it's not a crime, categorically. But the answer is, that's when they were in the Midbar. That is exactly how things need to be done. But here they're moving into Eretz Yisrael. So this is a last resort. You don't want to be without the matter. But that's not your plan A. So Moshe takes the matter. But he takes it milifnei Hashem. The matter is, but he hasn't seen it for a while. They haven't used it. But he may need it now. So he takes it milifnei Hashem. And so, Moshe gathers the Bnei Yisrael. But here begins the problem. For Moshe judges that the Jewish people are not compatible with what is expected of them. They're not ready. They will not rise to the occasion. And therefore, his words to them are, Shimon HaMorim, he judges them as rebelling somewhat. They're not in a state that they will be able to be misorer and to daven in the way that they should. And therefore he's looking to be ma'orer them. And what does he say? Shimon HaMorim, Hamin HaSela HaZem Atzila Chemai? Are we to extract water from this rock? That's his question. And it is a rhetorical question. We understood that the answer is yes, of course. But actually, the ideal is no. Moshe is saying to Bnei Yisrael, do you wish for this to be like it always was? That we extract it for you? Unnaturally? It shouldn't be that way. Today, you're looking forward to something else. It should be giving its water, but that demands something of you. Now, as far as Moshe was concerned, this was, and this is an amazing point, this was a fulfillment of the instruction for Dibarta Melasela, speak to the rock. Meaning, you're meant to be saying words of his orus. Well, that's what Moshe did. He's telling the Jewish people to get themselves together. Do you wish for this to be like you haven't advanced at all? I'm just going to extract the water like I always did? I mean, those are words of his orus. They're somewhat blunt and to the point. But that's speaking to the rock. Nothing happens. No one responds. And therefore, Moshe concludes that the Jewish people indeed are not ready for plan A. And so he moves to plan B. And he hits the rock. So now the question is, where do things go wrong? That's the important question. Of course, it's the hardest question to answer. But it seems from the Mefarshim, especially with the Medrash tells us and the Rambam, it certainly seems to be going in this direction, that Moshe got angry at Bnei Yisrael. Now getting angry at Bnei Yisrael, it's not the first time and it's not the last time, and how is that the sin here? But if we understand that it became a catalyst for a hasty judgment, that is to say, if Moshe is angry at Bnei Yisrael, and we always remind ourselves, this is Moshe on the day that his sister died, and the best condolence the Jewish people can come up with is to say there's no water. So in terms of reacting to the situation, for whatever, however much that accounts for. So when Moshe was looking to be ma'orer the people, when he was looking to prod them, really, to get themselves together, if he did so in a way that was too harsh, he may have startled them. They may not have known what to do and how to react and what to say. And if Moshe takes that lack of reaction as lack of will, then it was wrong to move to plan B. Because plan A had not been fully explored. As if to say, it could be, and this HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, Yan Lohe Mantim Bi. Had they gone about it the right way and been slightly more, this is us, of course, light years away from them, but trying to understand the lesson from the Parsha here, had they been more encouraging of the Bnei Yisrael and less critical, perhaps they could have brought the Jewish people to a state that they would be able to receive the water in a natural way. And on this, Aaron is criticized as well as Moshe, because in terms of preparing the Jewish people, Aaron was also meant to be speaking to them. And therefore, HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, Yan lo he'emantem bi. That's very interesting. Yan lo he'emantem bi. You did not promote faith within me. What does that mean? We ask the questions, what is the difference between hitting and talking? The difference between them is, are we staying with things as they are in the Midbar, or have we began to format the Jewish people for life as it will be in Eretz Yisrael? As long as they only ever receive water in the Midbar, in this unnatural way, they will never have had experience of how to get water in a natural way. That could have been invaluable for them as they go into Eretz Yisrael. It could have been their first experience and set the tone for things to come. That would be called he'emantebi. They will always think back to that first time when Moshe was with them and he's guiding them and coaching them through how to get water. If there's no water, that may have become the way they faithfully adhere to the time in Eretz Yisrael. And who knows what else? Mitzvah gereres mitzvah. But yan lo he'emantem bi. And what's very interesting is, elsewhere, in the end of Parshas Hazinu, HaKadosh Baruch Hu uses a different term for what went wrong in Mei Meriva, and says, Asher me'altem bi. Me'altem, me'ila, that's a very harsh term. And how is it applicable here? Me'ila represents an inappropriate use of something holy. That's me'ila, as we know, is a halachic category. It belongs to holy, and to use it for unnecessarily. That's what's happening when Moshe hits the rock. Because to hit the rock, it's a holy act. It's a miracle. But it shouldn't have been necessary here. They should have used the natural form to use something supernatural when it should not be the desired route. It's ultimately me'ila. It's a misappropriation of something holy. They should have used something more normal in order to extract the water, or for the rock to give its water. And perhaps one may say, with reservations, of course, but as we know, from a certain point of view, the notion that Moshe is not going into Eretz Canaan is already casting a shadow from the time of the Meraglim. In Chumash Devarim, in Parshas Devarim, when Moshe criticizes and rebukes the Jewish people for what happened with the Meraglim, he says, Gambi hisanach Hashem biglalchem. Hashem also was angry with me because of you. And the Mefarshim asked, Rishonim, how is Hashem angry with Moshe over the Meraglim? Moshe's Mei Meriva, it's not Meraglim. So why is there anger against Moshe, so to speak, already from the time of the Meraglim? As the Rechaim HaKadosh points out, as a result of the Meraglim, Golus was slated as more or less inevitable for the Jewish people. Hashem said, you cried for nothing, it's Tisha B'Av, there will be things to cry over in future Tisha B'Av. As the Pasuk says in Tehillim, at that time, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, La'pil zaram ba'goyim ulezarosam ba'arotzos. They will be dispersed amongst the nations. The Jewish people can't go into Golos if Moshe brings them into Eretz Yisrael. The Gemara tells us in Masechet Sotah, Moshe built the Beis HaMikdash, it could never be destroyed. But if the Beis HaMikdash isn't destroyed, that's the only way that the wrath can be diverted from the Jewish people. As the Pasuk says, Mizmor la'asaf. It's a silver lining, but it's a happy song. Elokim, bo'u goyim b'nachal asecha, timu asecha kachecha. They destroyed the Beis HaMikdash. What's happy about that? What, the comfort is that it was the Beis HaMikdash that took the destruction and not the Jewish people. But if the Beis HaMikdash can't be destroyed because it's built by Moshe Rabbeinu, the Jewish people can't go into Golos. But if they deserve Golos, then it's an untenable situation. And that's why Moshe already is incompatible with the Jewish people leading them in. So what's that got to do with Mei Meriva? There's no question that it is ultimately tied to Mei Meriva. But perhaps we may suggest that Golos could have been averted. Had Moshe spoken to the rock, he would have formatted the Jewish people for successful living in Eretz Yisrael, for maintaining their connection with HaKadosh Baruch Hu as they enter into the physical sphere of Eretz Yisrael, which was the transitional event that was meant to bring that about. Then had the Jewish people entered Eretz Yisrael empowered by that, and educated by that, and fortified by that, they may never have had to leave. It could be that they could have reclaimed the correct entry into Eretz Yisrael. And thus we find that it was the Makkah B'Patish, the final blow, where not only is Moshe not able to go into Eretz Canaan as from the time of the Meraglim, but what happens when he hits the rock is that he seals the exit from that situation, that perhaps they could have returned to a state that Moshe could have brought them in to Eretz Canaan. That is possible food for thought based on the approach of the Netziv. We'll leave it over there.